All right, I hope you're doing well. My name's Matt Williams, and I get the opportunity to teach this weekend all of our campuses. And it's great to be able to gather around the Word and to be able to listen and hear what God has for us. And there's going to be, I think, just maybe a couple things. The first two chapters, we're still setting the context and the setting for the tension that is coming as we see God deliver. But it's important to kind of take that time. But there'll be at least a couple points that I think will be worth reflecting on. Before we jump in, Sunday night we have what we call Night of Prayer. And I think we might have a slide for that. And just to remind you, coming on Sunday night at the different campuses that are permanent, so Pelham Road and downtown and Harrison Bridge and Powdersville. So we'll be gathering to worship. We're excited about it. It is one of our values to be able to say as much work as we have to pour in, as much as there is to do and take responsibility for, we have to be reminded that the great work that God is doing is the work that He's doing in us. And it is the work that we have to be dependent on Him for. And so we have to come together at certain points corporately where we acknowledge this is your work, we are dependent on you, we're calling out on you, and some of us are in great need. So to be able to come together and have people pray for us, or to be in an environment where people are praying, can be very, very healing and restorative. And then for some of you, you're like, I'm great, I don't need to come to Night of Prayer. Well, you're coming to contribute. You're coming to pray for people. So there's this individual piece, there's this corporate piece, and we know from the book of Revelation that Jesus is incredibly aware and concerned about what's going on in the life of the church. He has clear direction, clear concerns, really frustrated, really happy. And so He is aware of what's going on in the church. And so we need to call out to Him so that He can speak to us and lead us. It's a very important time of prayer. So, hope to see you. Turn to Esther chapter 2 if you're not already there. I know it was read by your campus pastor, campus host. A few things as we are thinking about what happened last week in chapter 1. This is a book that reads like your life. It has the randomness, the complexity, the logic of the way that your life flows. All of that is there. It takes time for the plan to unfold and to see, oh, okay, this is what God is doing. We're getting ready to make the case that there's a sovereign hand that is moving, that is in charge, that though it's not directly acknowledged, which is incredibly important in the flow of this book, that God's name, that who He is not being acknowledged, because we get to bring that to it, that there's a sovereign hand that is moving things, that will reverse the roles, that will change the dynamics, it's headed in one direction, we'll see it move in another direction. It's completely unpredictable, and that's who He is. And then for us, for a group of people who are scrambling for control, it's incredibly important that we understand that that is not what God's offering. Here I am, I'm your God, you give me some money, say my name real well, practice saying Yahweh a lot, tell other people about that, and then I'll do whatever you want. God says not what He's offering. He is offering to be the God of your life, your Redeemer, but you're never going to enter into the driver's seat and be in control of what He's doing. And so as people who are scrambling for control, it's quite difficult. So we saw in chapter 1, very powerful king. We saw this random dispute of this royal couple. We saw this random vacancy be created. We saw for the queen's role, we saw the possibility that another queen could be raised up. And this week we'll see where the weak meets the strong. The strongest man on earth meets one of the weakest women on earth. All right, so Esther chapter 2. And yes, there's going to be a piece in here that's a little disconcerting for some of us. But we'll get to it. Esther 2, verse 1. After Xerxes' anger had subsided, almost like he sobered up. It's been a few years. It's been 4 years, actually. Maybe Thermopylae, the movie 300, probably happens during that season between the two queens when he goes and fights Greece. Doesn't go well. But after his anger subsided, after he sobers up from the wine and from his anger, he realizes, I really am lonely. I've been thinking about Vashti. But notice what it says. Thinking about Vashti and what she had done. I mean, that's a man, got to hang in there, right? Got to hold the argument, got to hold the line. I mean, I'm so sad she's gone. I hate it that that's what she did. I just think that's funny. All right, that's just me. Not going to give up on his point. I can appreciate that in a man. So you got to call in the brain trust. His personal attendant suggested, verse 2, let's search the empire. We'll find beautiful young women. Could be virgins, could be women of this age. We'll appoint the king's agents to find these beautiful women in all the provinces. We'll find them. We'll bring them into the harem. Verse 4, and after that, the young woman who most pleases the king will be made queen instead of Vashti. This advice was appealing. Now, mark that paragraph. It's obscure, right? It is obscure. But just mark it, because what happens? The king is sad. The brilliant men who work with him have thoughts. Is this a good idea? I mean, I don't know. Probably good, maybe not. I don't know, right? But just their creative ability to say, we'll search the kingdom, we'll find someone, and out of however many girls that is, surely you'll find one, and life will be great again. But just whose idea is that? It is clearly a practical response to his emotional dilemma to not have a woman that he is really pleased in. It is their practical exercise and a brilliant idea to solve his problem. And that's clearly what has happened here. So circle that paragraph. And then when we're done with the book, then come back and read that paragraph. It's fascinating to think about. Once we've traveled the road and then come back and look at his emotional dilemma and look at their brilliant idea and go, now whose idea really was that? It is really, this the way the book is written, it's to stir your thinking along those lines. I think it's really important. Verse 5. At that time, there was a Jewish man in the fortress of Susa whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair. So the story for Esther really starts with this male that's been caring for her. Verse 7. The man had a very beautiful and lovely cousin, Hadassah. And so beautiful and lovely, the redundancy is important. Is that we can't drive the point home well enough how compelling she is, how striking she is, how beautiful she is. When you see her, you're not going to not notice. Like, this is who she is. It is a defining characteristic for her. Not the defining, a defining. The man had a very beautiful and lovely cousin, Hadassah. So, Hadassah, sound familiar? So, 2000 election, presidential election, vice presidential candidate on the Democratic side, Joe Lieberman. His wife's name is Hadassah, right? So it's a very well-respected, traditional name in Jewish culture even now. So her name is Hadassah, who was called Esther. When her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her. The way the language is phrased, because the language later on in this chapter and throughout the book at different points is very sensual. Erotic's too strong, but very sensual language with strong sexual overtones. None of that here. This relationship is clean, right? This is familial kind of relationship. They are family. He's taken this young woman in. He's been kind to her. She's very compelling. Verse 8. As a result of the king's decree, Esther, along with many other women, were brought to the king's harem at the fortress of Susa and placed in Haggai's care. So she was brought along with other women. So when you're reading this as a Jewish nation that has experienced exile, then you realize that she has been living in the exile. She's been living in captivity. And now she's gone into captivity again. She's double exiled. She is not living in her homeland, whether she is regretful of that or not. She's living in exile. And then even within the exile, she's exiled again. Right? So she's... At least she's with some of her family. She suffered a tragic loss, but even she's in exile, but at least she's with some of her family. Well, even that has been taken from her now. So she's been exiled twice. Verse 9, Haggai was very impressed with Esther and treated her kindly. So now there's a cascade of words that begin to fall over the cliff here. So very impressed with Esther, treated her kindly. Notice all the activity words or descriptive words. He quickly moves towards her and ordered a special menu. So these women are being treated in a very special way anyway, but among them, there's something about her that stands out. We're going to say her beauty at this point. Very quickly ordered a special menu. He moves towards her. He notices that even among these special women, there's something special about her. So she's special among the special. gets a special menu for her, provided with her beauty treatments. He also assigned her 7 maids. Like, who gets that? Like, what would they do? Like, how do you keep that many people busy? She didn't have anything to do but look good. I'm not being critical. I'm just saying. It's hard to, I got 5 kids. It's hard to keep them all engaged. Clean up the iron, vacuum the floor, mop. I mean, how do you keep 7 people? Pat my face. Make me look better. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know. I never put on makeup. Oh, no, it goes. 7 maids specially chosen for the king's palace. And he moved her and her maids into the best place. So it's kindly, quickly, special menu, beauty treatment, 7 maids specially chosen. Go to the king's palace. Maids the best place in the harem. So she gets, it's like boom, 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 boom. She's being elevated. Here's what we know. We know she's special. The only reason at this point we know about her being special is that she's beautiful. We know that. Which is something. It's powerful. So we know she's beautiful. You're going to get the sense pretty quickly because of how people connect to her. She's probably very intuitive. She's probably that gal that when she meets you, she reads your mind. She's a here, there you are rather than here I am kind of a person. She probably connects real well. She's probably real intuitive. So she seems to have some real gifts. She's beautiful, talented, intuitive, good with people. She's been granted favor. And we're going to start to see, the case is going to build pretty quickly, particularly for the original audience, is they're going to go, well, God's with her. No one's that pretty. I mean, God is with her. But we're starting to see a reversal in her original status, right? Because she's poor, or she's a woman, she's exiled, she's Jewish, she's an orphan. All of that is being reversed slowly. But when you read that, though, you're like, look at all these great things happening to her. But remember, her life's still complicated. Lost her parents, right? Now she's been exiled for the second time. She's been taken away. So think of the number of choices that have been taken away from her. About where she's going to live, who she's going to marry, what she's going to do with the rest of her life, how many children she's going to have, who she wants to be with romantically, what she'd like to accomplish and do, all of that. Stripped away because one king says, I need some women in here to choose from. Like, don't miss that part. So we get caught up in things are going so well for her, but she has lost everything in this a couple times. Verse 10. Esther had not told anyone her nationality and family background because Mordecai had directed her not to. We see this theme will appear a couple times, is that she is maintaining her connection to her original family and her culture through obedience, right? Is that she is, as many things are happening and life's clicking along for her and it's taking a new spin and a new turn. She's been dragged into another world against her will. Even with that, there's some really cool things about it, but she is remembering who she is. She is not completely lost in the moment. So she's in the moment, but she's got this other thing happening in her mind of where she comes from and who she's connected to. There's some tension there that at this moment is starting to build. It's going to get a lot bigger. Verse 11. Every day Mordecai would take a walk near the courtyard of the harem and find out how Esther, how she was doing, what was happening to her. So he feels responsible. He finds a way to stay connected. He cares for her. Verse 12. Before each young woman was taken to the king's bed, she was given the prescribed 12 months of beauty treatment. 6 months with oil and myrrh, followed by 6 months with special perfumes and ointments. Okay, I don't know anything about this. It just seems overkill. But here's what I'm going to do. I said earlier this week, I'm going to just do it now publicly. My wife deserves a massive apology for all the times I have raced her out of the bathroom, out of the kitchen, out of the house. Woman, it takes you. We got married. I was like, how long does it take you to get ready? We are going to the grocery store. It's called a baseball cap. Right? I owe her an apology because this is 12 months. I got nothing to complain about, right? She's low maintenance compared to this. You just think, really? 12 months? What are we doing? 13. When it was time for her to go to the king's palace, she was given her choice of whatever clothing. I mean, just think about, what is the story here? I mean, we are getting such a small piece of the story. What in the world is this world like? Like, what is the culture really like? What is the day really like? What are these people, these men, these women, what is all of this really like? What would it be like? You're given a choice of whatever clothing or jewelry she wanted to take from the harem. So there's resources there that she can take with her to help impress the king. That evening, she was taken to the king's private rooms, and the next morning, she was brought to the second harem where the king's wives lived, kind of wives. So after she spends this night with the king, she's moved to a new living situation. Is it disturbing? A little bit. Verse 14, halfway through. There she would be under Shaasgaz's care, the king's eunuch in charge of the concubines. So if you try to get your mind around a woman who's dragged into this situation against her will, and it doesn't go well with her and the king, and so she faces another form of exile in this concubine status that may never amount to anything. He may never call for her again. She may never see the king again. They may never have any contact, but then she's not going to have contact with anybody else, any other men. So, taken to verse 14, and there she would be under the care of Shaashgaz with the concubines. She would never go to the king again unless he had especially enjoyed her or requested her by name. So you're processing, you're going, okay, wait a minute. So she actually goes, that's what she's given this task to go be with the king for a night. That is not exactly living in a pure way until you get married, one man, one woman. Here's the thing. It's a descriptive story of what happened. Different culture, a different time. Doesn't mean it was right, it was wrong. But this is the culture they live in. They've been absorbed into it. It's not prescriptive for how you should live at every point. There's plenty of passages that give us direction on how to live an upright and righteous moral life. This is not one of those. This is a book telling us about what happened in God's sovereignty in a difficult moment. Now, where it gets complicated, as you think about it, because God is sovereign over the story, over the situation, where it gets complicated is what she does, what she's told to do, and it's wrong, but she does it, and God blesses it. Now, that's a little complicated. And that's where Christians get lost sometimes. Is you gotta maintain that tension of, there are things that happen in life, and there are things that we do, and God winds up using it, and not just using it in a restorative way, he winds up using it in a very powerful way as a blessing. So then it raises the question, well, gosh, I mean, maybe I should just be sinning all the time. Because there's other laws they're not keeping. There's food laws and Sabbath laws. There's other things they're not keeping. And yet God's still accomplishing what he wants to accomplish. So then there's a part of you that goes, well, wait a minute. If God's sovereign, he's going to do what he's going to do. And he's going to even use my sin to glorify himself. Then maybe I should just sin all the time because he's got that. Romans 5. This argument's already been made. You know that, right? All right, so, okay, good. So at the end of, people are like, yes, it has. I'm like, thank you. So glad, right? The end of Romans 5, he's saying where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. In other words, there's no sin more powerful than God's grace and his sovereignty and his ability to restore and heal and overcome. Because nothing's more powerful than the death of Jesus, except unbelief. And so he says, you know, if I'm going to sin and grace abounds, then maybe I should just sin more. So then at the beginning of chapter 6, he goes, absolutely not. It's meganoita. It's a huge no. Mega no. Not a good way to think. Though God is sovereign all of all that, he calls us to live in a way that glorifies him. And so we have to live with this tension that God is sovereign and in control. Is that he takes the most broken parts of who we are and he can use that to change us and change the world. It's his ability to reverse, which is what happens at the cross, is that those of us who are far away are reversed and brought close to God. Jesus, who's close to God, one with him, is reversed and taken far away, and God cuts him off for us. Though he was rich, became poor for our sakes, cut off on the cross. And so there is this reversal, but our sin does leave scars. It does have consequences. That's part of it. But there is this tension here of that God takes a very normal life and our brokenness and sin is able to use it and bless it. This is what's happening here. Verse 15. I probably didn't explain that well, but you get the idea. Verse 15. When it was Esther's turn to go to the king, she accepted the advice of Haggai. So in the beginning, like in 13, it just says she can choose whatever she wants. But she accepted his advice And she asked for nothing except what he suggested. He goes, honey, we got all this stuff you can take. You can dress like that. You can dress like this. You can wear all this necklace. You can do all that. But here's what I would suggest. I happen to know him. Here's what you should wear. And so she's able to kind of hone it down and listen to him. She asked for nothing except what he suggested. And she was admired by everyone who saw her. People who see her, people who engage her. He is overwhelmed by her. She accepts his advice. And it just shows, it keeps coming up, her ability to engage and win people. Her ability to come up underneath authority or to ingratiate herself. And it really does kind of stand as a contrast against Vashti, who, hey, come to the party. No, I'm not coming. And then so this resistance with Vashti, and then with Esther, her graciousness and her ability to come up underneath. Now, that's not making Vashti, the point is not to say Vashti was a terrible wife and got what she deserved and she's rebellious and not submissive. It's not about marriage, okay? The book's not about marriage. It's not about women's rights and feminism, and it's not about any of that. What it is showing, though, is a contrast between these two women. And though Vashti, she probably has very good points and very good reason for why she's doing what she's doing. The point is, it's just that something about Esther, Hadassah, is just stellar. It's just in another category as a person. That's the idea. She was admired by everyone. Verse 17. And the king loved Esther more than any of the other women. Like so many women, loves her. So random. That's the way it's written, right? He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. Like, she was an orphan, right? Jewish, in exile, on the outside, now brought in. All as a result of an argument from this royal couple, banishment of the queen, search for a new woman. Esther stands out. They make her queen. I mean, there is this, she was nothing, now she's at the highest place. There's just this reversal, this turn. It seems so random, or it could seem logical because she's pretty, who knows, right? And here's what's interesting. The characters in the story, the way it's presented to us, they're completely oblivious to how the movement, what's going on. They don't know. They're just surviving. They're just responding to the moment. They're just surviving. They're just trying to be in it. But the original audience, the readers, and we'll talk more about this next week, the readers, the people, not us, the original audience that this was written for, that Jewish nation, as they read it, God is popping off the pages at them. They're like, she's beautiful. She's not that beautiful. They had an argument, and he kicks her out. Well, I mean, they're seeing at every turn, they're seeing God's hand moving, and they're supposed to see that because God's not in the story. They're supposed to bring God to the story and see that none of this would happen without God, and that's supposed to remind them, and nothing will be happening with us either if God wasn't doing it. And just like if God is sovereign in this story, God is sovereign in our story. If God can move behind the scenes with them, then God can move behind the scenes with me. So as you read it, we're coming to it much like the original audience. Oh, this reads exactly like my wife. My wife. reads so much like Vicky. Be thinking about that all week. Okay, what Freud, what was the saying? What was going on right there, right? So, like, when I am 18 years old, there's been a series of events in my life, in my family, in my personal life, and then with my immediate family that changed from high school to college and then a few other events along with it that were disorienting. And so I was disoriented. And it was real confusing, and my parents had moved, so I was living with my grandmother, and so it was just a real disorienting time. And it was about 12 months where a number of things in my life were being deconstructed and then reconstructed. But it didn't feel like that, okay? It didn't feel like we're going somewhere. And as I look back at it now, there's about, and I counted them up yesterday, there's about six So there was a handful of things that happened that were real disruptive, that I became lost, okay? And then there was six things that I can count that have nothing to do with each other, that came in different ways, different shapes, in different directions, that created like a little path to follow. And in the moment, you're just surviving and trying to figure out who am I and what is the world, and everything that I thought was this way, now that it's not that way, and there's this way. And I wound up making a few decisions, two or three decisions that were real easy to make because of the little path that was being created, which seemed so random at the time. I made two or three decisions that were real simple to make, but there was two or three other decisions that were real difficult. So a couple things were simple, a couple things were really hard. And at least one of those decisions, I had to go back to my original family and say, hey, when I was 19 and I did this, you got left, and I went that direction, and that left you. And even to my brother a couple weeks ago, we talked about this. I said, I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing, but I just feel like it's not good. And he was very gracious and just said, no, you did what you were supposed to do. And part of that is why you are where you are now and why you're doing what you're doing. All of this comes out of that. But in that season, I couldn't see that I had been disoriented by a series of events, and I couldn't see that I was being given direction by a series of events. And I was trying to read the scriptures, but I had no community, no mentor, no leadership, no discipleship, no direction. And so now, looking at it, it was like God dropped these big glowing buoys out of the sky into my life, but most of them did not seem overly spiritual by any stretch. They just gave me a little bit of direction to the next place. And then when I got there, it just seemed like something else happened, and I got to the next. And now, looking back, it's so clear to me, as an audience that would read the story, look at what God's doing. Look at that. Look at that. I mean, that is so fascinating. But when you're living that story, it does not feel like that at all. It feels like survival. And I'm probably destroying myself, and I don't know what I'm doing. And so this is the way we read the story. They are living it, trying to survive, trying to figure it out. Verse 18. To celebrate this occasion, the making of the queen, he gave a great banquet. So the book starts with three banquets. One of those Vashti gives for herself and for her women. But to celebrate this occasion, the king gives a great banquet in Esther's honor for all the nobles, declaring a public holiday. Really, the word is declaring public gifts. And so we just assume it's like he relieved the taxes for the day, or he gave a holiday, gave them time off, or gave everybody in town a gift, or in the nation. It's more of like the relief of something or the gift of something. And so to celebrate the occasion, he throws a big party and he does something for everybody. And so now what's been associated with Hadassah? Blessing. Like when this woman comes in, she's so beautiful, she's so engaging, she's so deferential, you can't help but be won over by her. And now I never even met her, but I'm the governor of this province, and all I know is I got the day off and the king has sent this blessing to me because he's celebrating her. So now she means blessing to me. She's now brought blessing into my life. So that's now how they're experiencing. So the Jewish orphan woman who was way on the outside compared to the king who had 127 provinces is now throwing a banquet for her, and he's elevated her. There's this reversal that we keep talking about. And so what it reminds us is no matter how strong and secure you think you are, everything is not as it seems. And no matter how weak and frail you think you are, and you feel that, everything is not exactly as it seems. Now, if it was all in your hands, and you were in charge, and you were in control, everything would be exactly as it seems. But the unpredictable nature of the world you live in shows that it is not you, and not me, it is not us, not we who are in control. Right? That the unpredictable nature, the reversal that we see, the irony that we see, lets us know that someone else is actually in control. Verse 19. Finish up, 19 and 20. Even after all the young women had been transferred to the second harem and Mordecai had become a palace official, Esther continued to keep her family background and nationality a secret. She was still following Mordecai's directions just as she did when she was in his home. We are seeing the beginning of a massive amount of tension that is starting to build between her two identities. This hidden Jewish identity that no one knows about where she came from. She hasn't told anybody about that. And now she's the queen in this Persian Empire, this Jewish thing back here, and this identity. She got these two identities that do not mix. And she's managing it. She's going to obey. She's going to obey this man who was the leader, authority, caregiver in her life, and she's going to obey here as long as she can. But these two worlds are getting ready to collide, and she's going to have to make a choice at some point about where she's going to align herself. And in your alignment, it tells about who you trust, okay? Whoever you align yourself with, when push comes to shove, when the pressure comes down, your alignment talks about who you trust and what you really believe in. We got that? These two worlds are coming together, still obeying, still listening, still trying to honor. And here's what it does tell you too. The other thing it tells you is that when you get, and I was just talking to a young dude about this not too long ago, when someone gets everything they want in life, it tells you a lot about what's in their soul, right? Because now they're all powerful, they have what they want, the sense of independence is there, so it just tells you what's going on in their soul. And the other extreme is, when they don't get what they want, it tells you a lot about what's in their soul. And that's exposing for all of us. But we're seeing some of that in her. She's getting everything that she wants, relatively speaking. And it says good things about what's happening. And we're going to see some of that come out. Let me ask you this question before we're done. And we'll pray and we'll worship together. I shared a version of this a long time ago. A friend of mine had gone through a real hard time. And afterwards we were talking. And I said, how are you doing now with that wilderness experience, that testing is over? He said, you know, I'm so embarrassed. I was like, well, what are you embarrassed of? There's only about five of us that even know what you've been going through. And he said, you know, I'm just embarrassed because my wife and God. And because, I mean, I was just, now it's all worked out. But in the middle of it, I was panicking. He goes, and I teach the Bible for a living, and I was panicking because I was afraid of everything. And I thought about that. I've done a fair amount of counseling, and you see it in people's life. When you get into that point where you're being squeezed down, it exposes what you trust in or what you don't trust in. It exposes all your weaknesses, and it shows how fragile you really are. And I've experienced it, and I've felt the same thing that he's talking about. When the testing is over, you look back, and you're like, oh, the next time I go through something like that, which I hope I never do, but the next time I go through something like that, I'm determined to be more trusting, more faithful, more stable, less erratic, whatever. So that idea, we've all experienced it, but that raises, this is my question. If we really thought that God was in control, that he was sovereign, what would that change about the way I think, the way I feel, the way I believe, and the way I live? Like if I really thought, because let's just be honest, most of us think, feel, believe, live in such a way it reflects the idea that on the deepest level we believe that we're in charge. And then when we feel like we're not, then we're victims of some big system that's rallied against us. But what would life be like? How would we respond to other people, treat other people? How would we bear up under suffering? How would we manage our success, the windfall of resources that comes our way, the talent that we have that other people don't have, the brain power, the skills, some of the things that we're able to accomplish that other people can't accomplish, some of the things that we can't do now that we used to could do, some of the loss, some of the failure, our response to difficult times and difficult people. Good times, bad times. What would be different if we actually thought that God was in control and some of the circumstances that we're facing, as much responsibility as we have, some of the circumstances we're facing might have been preordained. I might be walking on a path that was determined a long time ago I was going to walk on this path. And I'm frustrated about being here, but I may not even be choosing to be here. This might be the path that he has for me in this season, and this is the work that I have to do. And what would it look like if I felt like for a moment that he actually created this moment and I'm just living in the wake of what he's created? Still fully responsible. Still got to own what I got to own. But this is the work that he's doing. This is the life he's given me for now. It raises some deep questions we need to struggle with. Let's pray together. Father, we have more questions than we have answers as we read a book like this. And as we're still building the story, and we're still learning, and we're still thinking, we want to be living in the same space that Mordecai is, as his daughter-like person in his life is, that she's been ripped away from him and he's trying to find a way to care for her. As this young lady has had the rest of her choices taken away from her. And she's been forced into a situation that most women would never choose, and now finds herself elevated in a way that she never dreamt could have happened. Her whole world has been reversed and turned around. Father, the tension that she feels, the tension that Mordecai feels, could you help us imagine that and begin to see some of that's the same tension that we're living with? So would you show us where we do trust you, where we don't? Show us where our hearts need to be turned towards you, and you open us to the idea of the work that you're trying to do. Show us how to trust you better. Pray that you would speak to us and that we would be responsive, knowing that you've been patient with us. You've been gracious with us for a long time. Continue to do your work. It's in your name.